Well, good morning, everyone. We're coming to the final chapters of the Gospel of Luke as we're entering into Lent. Blessed Ash Wednesday to all of you. I probably say this every year, but you know, when you're thinking, you probably already have your Lenten resolutions all worked out and whatnot. But you know, if you're still kind of, you haven't quite committed yet, I always find the helpful one for me, or helpful way of discernment for me, the first thing that comes to mind that I think, oh no, not that, that's probably the thing that you need. Whatever just looms up right away is just like, I can't live without that. That's probably the thing you need to give up. And again, the idea, of course, is not that you know, you get through 6 weeks of that and you've suffered and suffered and suffered, and now you get to Easter and you sort of jump in with both feet. The idea would be that somehow at the end of that 6 weeks, you're freer from it. It's not as if you just maybe give it up entirely, but somehow you are really not as dependent on it as you need to be. And yes, I will talk to 10th graders about, they probably should consider kind of scaling back on their electronics. That is the thing for them that would immediately... In fact, that wouldn't crop up as the, oh no, not that, because they would think of giving up electronics no more than they would think of giving up oxygen or water or, you know, the basic necessities of life. But that probably is the thing that they... that for them is the most enchaining or enslaving to them, I think. As we last time, I had combined 19 and 20, and I think I said nothing about 20. So now we're on 20 and 21, and we'll just have this rolling effect that we'll get to the end, and we won't be able to say anything about the resurrection. You won't know how the gospel ended, but hopefully we'll be able to cover those things. I wanted to start with 20. Where is this? We talked about the authority of Jesus, but we didn't get to the wicked tenet. So that's verses 9 through 18. And a thing to understand about a vineyard, you know, just this, the sort of immediate consequence of a vineyard. Remember, these are not people who can, as it were, open the fridge and they got a variety of drinks. Right? Am I going to have Evian? Am I going to have my spring water? Am I going to have orange juice? Am I going to have Mr. Pibb's soda? Right? They don't. Am I going to have Fresca? They've got water, and the water tends not to be that reliable. And they've got some kind of fermented drink, and in the Near East, that's going to be wine. Generally, that's going to be wine. I had a housemate years ago who was a fallen away Catholic who had become evangelical and was convinced that Jesus didn't drink alcohol, that all alcohol was bad and whatnot. And I actually had to walk this kid through the Greek of the Old Testament, New Testament, that, because he was trying to tell me, oh, when they use that word wine, it just means grape juice. And I had to show him oinos. Right? Omicron, Yoda, Nu, Omicron, Sigma. What we say, O-I-N-O-S, oinos. And that's where we get the word wine from. So when, remember, Noah plants grapes, and he ferments them, and he drinks it, and he gets drunk, that's oinos. He is not getting a buzz from grape juice. And of course, fermentation generally allows whatever you're making to last longer and generally be healthier. So there's a lot of wine, watered-down wine, that's just a regular part of their diet. But in the Near East, it's a big deal that you have a vineyard. Think back to the second book of Kings, Naboth. Remember, Naboth has a vineyard. Ahab wants the vineyard, and basically he does this false accusation. He slanders this guy. He does this rigged trial so that he can take, you know, what we would in the modern world call eminent domain. He can, as the king, take this guy's vineyard. But that's what he has to do. Even as a pretty bossy, powerful king, you are really violating people's sense of what's fitting and right by taking somebody's vineyard. So to think of the equivalent, it would be like we talk about the cabin in the mountains, the beachfront property, or I think about this from my East Coast friends, the rent-controlled apartment that you've got in New York City. when you've got a rent-controlled apartment, you never let go of it. You inherit. You families pass on their rent-controlled apartments in New York City because they're so hard to, because they're so hard to get. So that's how you need to think of a vineyard. This is something that's providing one of the basics, and it's not easy to keep to get. And if you've got it, you don't let go of it. Okay, so the master, he's a way, whoever owns this vineyard, he's a way, he hires tenants to care for it. You don't want the thing to just, right, not be cared for. You want to keep getting your produce out of it. But evidently he's gone long enough that, as often happens, they tend to, the tenants now think of it as their own, right? They think of it as their own. Just like, you know, your kids, they live in those bedrooms that they call their room, and periodically you actually have to point out, no, this is my room. You are sleeping in my room because every room in this house is my room. My father had that explanation to me at one point where I had become confused about that. He clarified that matter for me. The master sends basically representatives, you know, kind of remind him he's coming, wants the produce. They kill the reps, they kill the messengers. He sends his son, and they just think, you know, if we kill the son, the thing is ours. Yeah, go ahead.
That was a legal thing I read. If there was no heir, anyone who worked the land for 3 years or more had a claim.
Yeah. So it's like when you're... what is that called? Well, squatter is the term that comes to mind, but it's not. Yeah, but that if you've been there long enough, you can, as it were, establish residency. Yeah, you got to be careful who's sitting on your land. And you're right, because notice what they say. Let's kill the heir, and the inheritance will be ours. So evidently, they've got some kind of legal idea that once they remove him, you know, they own the place. Now, the symbolism here, of course, is who are the messengers? Who's getting sent? These are the prophets. This is Jeremiah. This is Isaiah. These are all the prophets. And how do they get treated? They get treated exactly the way that's being talked about here. Finally, the Son comes, right? The Son of God. And they don't treat him any better, right? Their idea is we kill him and we will inherit. This will be ours. If you think about the words of... Caiaphas, do you not understand that if we do not, you know, sentence him to death, they will take away our nation? Do not you see it is expedient that one man dies so that we keep our nation? And the remarkable thing that John observes on that, he did not say that on his own, but as high priest. In other words, when he talked about Jesus dying for the nation, he is speaking prophetically. That's a great example, Caiaphas and also Jonah in the Old Testament. If you have the idea that prophets have to be good people, thankfully not. God is able to talk through wicked people. So I don't know if you'd say Jonah was wicked, but certainly he's not somebody who's a very, very dutiful messenger, right? I mean, his initial, he just tries to run the opposite direction. But remember, when he preaches to the Ninevites, 40 days and Nineveh will be destroyed, and then the prophecy doesn't happen. Jonah 4, he is all bent out of shape. He isn't, wow, that was a close breath. Wow, they repented. Rejoices in their dependence. No, he wanted to see them nuked. He wanted to be able to sit back and watch the mushroom cloud and, you know, eat popcorn. He wanted the Ninevites, the Assyrians, they're the enemy. Likewise, Caiaphas. Caiaphas prophesies and is part of, right, the machinery to execute our Lord, to kill our Lord. But he is still able to speak things that are inspired. And when he says that Jesus is to die for the nation and that Jesus' death will save the nation, that's true. He has a bad heart, but that's true. He is speaking prophetically. So that's the significance of why it's a vineyard. And in your book it'll refer you to Isaiah 5, because it's toward the beginning of Isaiah that it talks about, my beloved had a vineyard. And it's giving you this imagery, which is meant to correspond with the imagery of the way that the chosen people are supposed to, the church at that stage, the assembly, they're supposed to be following God, they're supposed to be fruitful, and they're not. You know, they are not living as they should, they're not following the commandments. Okay. As you get further in this, the question comes up about paying taxes. And of course everybody remembers this. Verse 25. Render to Caesar those things that are Caesar, to God those things that are God. And we are so used to that distinction that we don't realize that when you look at a lot of, you know, other cultures or a lot of other world religions, that distinction would not make any sense to them. In other words, the religion and the society, what you might call the religious law and the secular law, they are all wrapped up together. So you couldn't really distinguish the things that are God from God and the things that are Caesar from Caesar's. So what do I mean by that? Think, for example, about how it is that in what is called Sharia law, you know, where essentially in a traditional Muslim country, you are taking the Quran and you're taking Hadith and you are downloading that as the civil law. You know, as much as possible, you are taking what is in your religious text and downloading that. Okay, in India, traditionally Hinduism. Okay, and think about something like the caste system, where you have the priest class, the Brahmins at the top, the Kshatriya, the aristocrats, the Vaishyas, who are the merchant class, and then the Shudras, who are the kind of, if you like, working class, and then everything below that, the outcasts, the pariahs, right? Those people who are doing these things of the lowest of tasks that just, for life, render them ritually impure. You would not be able, with that kind of organization, to make any kind of separation between the religious and the secular. That would be impossible. The whole society is organized and stratified according to these religious distinctions of purity. Okay? When you say caste, that's from the Latin word castus, where we get the word chastity. And these are levels of purity. What kind of purity? Not just ritual purity in the sense of getting further away from or nearer to ritual contamination, but also to some degree racial purity. Those folks at the top of that caste system are Aryans. They're the descendants of these lighter skinned invaders from India thousands of years ago. The people on the bottom end of that caste system tend to be the darker skinned Dravidians. So when you talk about, when you hear terms like institutional racism, you know, compared to a lot of societies out there, there's a lot more mobility than there ever could be in something like a 2,500, 3,000-year-old caste system. And it's one of the things that continues to cause difficulties for a democratic India, an India that wants to be a democratic nation, that wants to have equality and so on. And there's just this continual problem of what are called the Dalits, this underclass that really goes back to this caste system of the untouchables. So those things are very, very difficult to separate. By contrast, think about when you read something like St. Peter or St. Paul, and they are telling Christians, obey the government, obey the king, follow the laws. When they wrote that, they are referring to rulers, none of whom are Christian. That's something you have to understand when you read those letters where Peter and Paul, they're exhorting people to obedience to the secular authority. None of those secular authorities are Christian. They're all pagan. And there's this idea that somehow God grants authority to the civic order, even when that civic order is not explicitly Christian, or in fact, Christian at all. So if you look, for example, at Romans 13, the prince is God's minister, executing justice, right? And this is a conclusion from his opening line, that all authority is from God, right? The wicked should fear the punishment of the prince, for the prince is God's minister. Okay, that doesn't mean he's God's minister. Again, he's religious. He's following the gospel. No, if he is executing just law, he is God's minister, regardless of what it is that he believes. That's why following civil authorities, even when those civil authorities here may be completely godless, is actually a Christian duty if they are enforcing, right, the moral law, if they're enforcing just laws. So that there are laws against theft and murder and kidnapping and fraud and embezzling and all that, you are obeying God's authority when you are obeying those laws. You're not just obeying like the Constitution of the United States or the Minnesota State Constitution. No, if they are just laws, they get their authority from God. Right? Even a totally, you know, secular, godless, you know, state government, they have authority if they are enforcing just laws. Okay? And, you know, when you read someone like Martin Luther King, when you read the letter from a Birmingham jail, that's kind of like the last gasp of that as a kind of a common belief. Because Martin Luther King will talk very matter-of-factly about just laws getting their authority from God. That's the whole argument for being able to protest unjust laws, like these laws of enforcing segregation in the South. The authority of a law comes from God. And it comes from God by being a just or moral law. So therefore, when you have a law that is unjust, that is against the moral law, the eternal law, the divine law, those are laws that should be resisted. Okay? I don't know how easily people would understand that now. Martin Luther King could talk in that language in the 1960s and still get a fairly wide audience in terms of understanding what that meant and what that was about. I think even a lot of Christians now would have a hard time with that. They wouldn't quite. They think of the Christian world as being the separate world unto itself, unrelated to the secular world, and then the secular world sort of over there, and it's all about rights and all about power, and they wouldn't be able to relate things that were moral or different levels of law. They wouldn't be able to fit that in. I know when I tell students, you know, speeding. If you're going 80 miles an hour in a school zone, that's not just illegal. That's immoral and sinful. And that's news to them because they don't think of crimes as being sins. Because they have this separation between the religious and the secular. They separate those things. And I point out to them, no, if you are disobeying a just law, that's not just illegal, it's immoral and sinful. Because if the law is just, you should be following it. Okay? All authority comes from God. All authority comes from God. The one further point I should say in contrast, when you look at people like the Calvinists in Geneva, so Calvin really did attempt to try to take the Bible and like download it as civil law, and it didn't work all that well. You know, the effort to try to take, and by the way, you have to try to take the Old Testament and do that. The New Testament doesn't lend itself very well to that at all. It's hard to do even if you wanted to be committed to it. You know, how do you take the Beatitudes and download that as law? You know, how do you download when you fast? You know, when you give alms, how do you download that as some sort of regulation? It doesn't do that. Students, in fact, are often surprised to find when I say, okay, you know, in a traditionally Muslim country, you're going to download, right, Quran and Hadith. So European law, here's Europe, evangelized, wall-to-wall Christian, what's the basis of its laws? And some kids will try, is it Old Testament, is it? Nope. And some of the smarter kids who remember their ninth grade history, they raise their hand, Roman law. They said, exactly. The whole basis for European law is Roman law. Why are they going to reinvent the wheel Rome had this wonderful administration, and it was wonderfully well organized. What are you going to reinvent the wheel for? So the basis of European law for centuries was Roman law. And the way you see that as a Catholic, when you look at canon law, the whole structure of canon law goes back to Roman law. It's evangelized Roman law. Okay? And sometimes canon law students will have to study Roman law and kind of the history of Roman law to understand the structure that's guiding canon law. Because it's not like English common law. English common law is a different kind of animal. And that's what we use in the United States because that's what developed in Great Britain. But English common law just works in a different way from the way Roman law does. If you're going to understand canon law, you can't come at it with English common law as your framework. You've got to be formed in this different framework. Okay, Sadducees and the resurrection. This is what...
Aren't those common laws, though, sort of based on the Ten Commandments?
Are you talking about English common law?
Yeah.
English common law, my understanding is that, I mean, yes, but the way that it develops by case law. There's this sort of accumulated, if you like, legal experience that forms the structure. So there are all these kind of, if you like, compromises, consensus, back forth. That you know, a man's home is his castle. You wouldn't just get that somehow as a first principle out of like the moral law or the natural law or the Ten Commandments. You get do not steal. But the way that property rights are enforced in the English-speaking countries is different from the way that it's done in a lot of our... So that expression, yeah, a man's home is his castle, you wouldn't quite be able to put that the same way in France or Italy. There isn't an equivalent to that. That's what I mean. There are these ways that the thing that allowed... Europe, or that allowed England not to have revolutions, was this continual give and take in the way that English power in England was shared, distributed, modified. It kept changing, giving and taking. The problem in places like France was it was a lot more rigid. So you just had to overthrow the thing in order for there to be change. In the English, you know, think about what's called the Glorious Revolution. I mean, basically, they kicked out one king and they made the agreement with William and Mary, okay, you two are going to be king and queen, but with the following understanding. And that's like a revolution. Okay, it's not really a revolution. What you've done is we are further limiting monarchical power, but we're limiting monarchical power according to this trend that this is the way things have been moving and we're just keeping it going that way. If that makes sense. Yeah, go ahead.
I feel like I'm still kind of a little bit confused on like civil disobedience and like Christians following laws that seem to be getting increasingly unjust.
Well, if they really are unjust, then that's where the civil disobedience comes in. That's what Martin Luther King was doing. Remember, he has to write that letter because he has clergymen in Birmingham who are telling him, you're breaking the law. We don't mind you protesting segregation because we think segregation... The clergymen who are criticizing King, they are not defending segregation. They all think that segregation is wrong. But they think that breaking the law is an extreme. Now, this is like... this. I don't have a lot of things to use as examples for 16-year-olds because they don't have something going on that's quite like this. But I tell them, in the 1980s and 90s, when people were doing abortion protests, there was in the pro-life community, you could have a solid group of people that they were all against abortion. Are we going to block clinics? Are we going to trespass on the property? You had people in the pro-life movement who said, no, that is too extreme. You had people in the pro-life movement, no, this is absolutely necessary. You have people, they got the same principle. But it's a kind of a high-stress, high-stakes thing. Are you going to break the law? Go ahead.
Well, I think we have a ton of examples going on right now. I mean, we have mask mandates and all this protocols.
No, yeah, but that I don't. But in terms of something I can use for them.
Canada. How about emergency laws and taking away democracy in Canada with the trucker thing? I mean, could you?
That wasn't available when that happened the last couple of weeks, and I was doing King like months and months ago, so. You know, that might have been something I could have availed myself of if it was a contemporary event, yeah. But what I told them was, you know, I could have said things related to masks as vaccines, but the way that I put it to them was, there may be all sorts of things out there that you have some sort of belief about it being unjust or wrong. Would you break the law? Are you willing, bless you, are you willing to have a felony on your permanent record as you apply to college? There may be all sorts of things out there that you think are wrong, that you think are really wrong. How far would you be willing to go? By the way, when I put it to them that way, I mean, their eyes get really big. I don't think readily they can think of anything that they really did that would hurt their chances to get into Princeton or Notre Dame. I don't think that really appeals to them as an idea. And I said, well, good. Now you understand. Because the problem is, if you go back and you read the letter from a Birmingham jail and you just think, well, of course they should have disobeyed the law. And of course they should have protests. And of course they should have shut down the city and so on. Okay, because it's no skin off your nose. And it's like, you know, this is all like 60 years ago. But if you're going to put yourself in at the time and understand why it was a controversy, you're going to have to understand that there are risks when you break the law. And it is an edgy proposition to break the law, you know, even though you think it's unjust. And you're right. I could give them those. And by the way, many of them probably would look at those truckers and they would say, no, the government shut you down anyway and it was totally quixotic, so what even was the point? It could be, quite frankly, that a lot of our students just think of the state as a kind of a Leviathan state. This is like, you can't fight City Hall. How on earth could you fight the state? It's everywhere. Its tentacles are in everything. How would you fight it? So that's my worry. I don't know that we have, you know, that we have young people that we have to restrain from taking on the, you know, the state. I think it's quite the opposite. You know, that it's just, it's all powerful. And especially if you're ambitious. Move off the mask mandate and vaccine and so on. Move over to the area of like critical race theory and gender and whatnot. If you're a young person, why on earth would you want to take a stand on those things if you're ambitious? Do you want to get blackballed for the Ivies? Do you want to get blackballed for Stanford? Do you want to get blackballed for these elite colleges? Shut up. Keep your head down. I will never forget this girl, this school who went to University of Madison. And the way she just told me, we were talking about how liberal the colleges have gotten, and she just said, I'm just going to stay quiet and keep my head down and get my degree. Now, I understand that as a strategy, but I got to tell you for myself, I could never do that. I could never do that. The idea that I'm just going to try to blend, be quiet, don't stand out, don't say anything. To me, that you would just spend 4 years doing that I think I'm not talking about moral compromise. That would just be so depressing. Yeah. Go ahead.
One of the conversations that occurred in our house was around George Floyd and the behavior, and to what point my girls sat and they went, they're breaking the Ten Commandments by looting and rioting.
Oh, sure.
Right? So
right.
They kind of looked at them and said, sure, we had friends going on the bridges and the streets, but then there was that line of, and we knew teenagers that went down and were a part of the anarchy part of things.
Yeah.
That was a conversation for them of right, wrong, moral law, civil law, but that example to them was, where's the line in the protest? Where you cross over and you're breaking the law? Is that right? And some people condoned it and said, this is pent-up anger. Allow them to have this temper tantrum and loot and steal and burn.
But I guess I got to say, pent-up anger, you're looting the wrong neighborhoods.
Right.
Oh, my word.
Right.
I mean,
yourselves.
You know, I remember I was out by Lake Minnetonka, and I was looking out at the sailboats, and I said, you know, here's where the power is. This is where the power structure is, baby. But it's just too far. It's just too far away. How are you gonna get all the angry people out here? You know. So instead, and this has been, you all know this. I mean, this has been going on for 60 years. who suffers when the neighborhoods go up in flames? It's the lower income people in the margins who are suffering. The power structure remains entirely comfortable, ensconced, and it's sometimes visibly fenced in neighborhoods, you know, complete with security. They are completely untouched. So that's something where I don't know that the issue is, hey, you're breaking the law and you're going extreme. It's like, you're not even breaking the law in a practical way that actually impacts the, you know, the very villains you the very people you believe are villains. The very people you believe are villains are actually miles away. It's just too far to get out to them. Almost like, you know, when Homer Simpson wants to buy a gun and they tell him, you know, there's a 7-day waiting period. I'm angry now! So let's talk about the Sadducees. We don't have a lot of time, and here we are with points 4 and 5. See, we only do one chapter at a time. The Sadducees... And you read it, and of course, with our understanding of the resurrection of the body and the Christian, you know, teaching in the afterlife, and they pose this scenario. Okay, there's this woman, she marries a man, he dies, another man, there's 7 men, they die, they're raised from the dead. Whose husband is she? And you read that and you just think, really? You know, you think this is a real objection. But that's because they are doing something that's actually much more common, I think, than we recognize. They are thinking of the afterlife like it's just like this life. That's how they're thinking about it. So if you think about, you know, why did the Egyptians build pyramids and for the Pharaoh and stuff all the furniture in there and the gold and whatnot? Because they thought they're going to rise from the dead, but they're going to rise from the dead like a life just like this one. So it's almost like you're going on vacation, you put a bunch of stuff in your storage unit, and you pull your stuff out of the storage unit. Well, I need my couch now, and I need my boat, and I need those bicycles. And so what our Lord says to them is the thing that we have to reflect on. The sons of this age marry, are given in marriage, but those who are kind of worthy to attain the age to the resurrection from the dead can neither marry nor are given in marriage. They cannot die anymore because they are equal to the angels and the sons of God. Okay? In other words, you are not entering into a life that is just like this one. And notice the connection that he makes between marriage and death. You know, as natural beings, as animals, part of the reason that reproduction is necessary for us is because we're mortal. You know, the fact that we bring children into the world is, in a way, a testimony to our mortality. This is just from our animal nature. Children are the way that we continue to live. That somehow we live again, you know, by having children. I think it's one of the things that, and this is totally, you can't explain this to 16-year-olds. Why your parents eventually want grandchildren? They don't want them now. They don't want them anytime soon. But eventually, they want grandchildren. They want you to have children. I know, you're just thinking, just so you can spoil them and like drop them back off at their parents. No, there's this way in which, again, you see yourself, you see your spouse. In a way, you see the older generation of your family living again through your children. It gives us kind of permanence. It gives us kind of stability. Again, just on that natural level. Just on that natural level. But, of course, we're supernatural as well. And so when we are entering into the afterlife, we are entering into a life that is different from this one. It's not just the same kind of life. Okay, it's not just the same kind of life. One of the things that that we have, sometimes juniors, sometimes seniors read, is... Mark Twain's Letters from the Earth. And Mark Twain, toward the end of his life, he died as an atheist. He stayed largely Christian through the influence of his wife, but within a very short span, as he was older, his wife died and his daughter died. And he was just heartbroken by that. And so all the, you know, Mark Twain is always kind of a bit on the edgy and cynical side. So even when his wife was able to like get him to go to church and believe in God, once he loses her, that's just gone altogether. So you read like his final works, Letters from the Earth, The Mysterious Stranger. These are works that really are sort of bitter, and they really are despairing. Anyway, in the Letters from the Earth, he has Satan writing letters to Michael, and that's hence the title Letters from the Earth. And Satan is ridiculing what it is that the Christians picture to themselves as heaven. They said, when you read, you know, you read the Bible, and it's like they're all in church, and they're all in church singing all the time. I mean, most Christians don't like being in church. They don't like singing in church. By the time they're at the end of the service, you can just see what a relief is on their face as they're ready to leave. And so what do they picture to themselves as heaven? Church, forever! Singing, forever! And the point, of course, that the reason we have them read this is what is central to the afterlife is that you are focused on God. That's the kind of churchy part of it. But you are not the person that you were. You are not the same person. So it's the comparison that I make to them. Actually, C.S. Lewis gives this. You know, children, they love candy and they love chocolate. And if you were to talk to them about, you know, sensual pleasure, if you were to talk to them about the love between a man and a woman, I mean, if you're 5 or 6, it's like, well, but do you get chocolate? You know? They don't understand that you still will like chocolate, but there are other things now that you like that you will like more. So, that the things that you like now and are important to you now, they will be to you in the future, like the way that, you know, these things that you liked when you were a child, that they will pass away or they will be less important. That's just hard to kind of wrap your mind around. But there's a way that as you mature spiritually, the things that you like and the things you give you joy change. So in a way, what Twain is describing is fallen humanity trying to find its happiness in God. Yes, you're right. They would probably prefer to be paralyzed in a sports bar in front of the, you know, in front of the game with, you know, chips and chips and dip and a 20-ounce you know, 20-ounce beer on tap. But to move into a supernatural life, we will not be what we were any more than when we move into marriage, right? We will be the 5 or 6-year-old that just wants to know, do I get chocolate with this? We will be different. We will be changed. So much to make up for, but we'll try to finish 2020 and get into 2021 and get this gospel done in the next couple of weeks. Very good. Have a beautiful Ash Wednesday. Oh, go ahead, Mrs. Zary.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Jesus says that, you know, not one stone will be left in the temple. Why have the wailing?
Because it's not. Again, this is something where it's not literal. In fact, that's something Josephus talks about. There are actually a couple of towers that were left. The Romans left a couple of towers. But it's like when the teacher says, you better study or this test is going to kill you. But I will talk about the temple next time. I'll start with that. Very good. Have a good week.